Contestant number 3002, Mr. Eric Harrison, Reel 8. Now, we mentioned the crew, because you had a new aeroplane as well, in the sense that you were going to be in the Sunderland now, the Sunderland Flying Boat, which is altogether different. Now, could you give it a bit, top to bottom, as much as you remember about what the Sunderland was like as an aircraft, as a flying boat?
Well, the Sunderland Flying Boat, anybody that was posted to flying, to doing his duties in a Sunderland Flying Boat, just thought that nothing could ever be better than this. The crews, generally speaking, were all highly experienced crack crews, a very, very high standard. The flying boat itself was a beautiful aircraft.
In what way? What was good about it?
Well, it in the air it you know it flew well, and we had bunks on board where we could sleep if we wanted to, and they did have to sleep in those bunks, because when we took off in the morning at 6 o'clock in the morning, there had to be crews on board guarding that boat all night long, because it was bombed up. That, you know, there was all the ammunition on board, and there was depth charges on board, and so it had to have people on board it. And those boys that whose names I've given you were the lads who had to go on board, and then they had to take off at 6 o'clock and do another duty. That in itself was quite onerous. So there were bunks on board, and if you wanted a rest, I couldn't have a rest because I was the only navigator. So I was always on duty when I was on board. So it didn't happen to me that way. But we had a wardroom where we had breakfast and
on the boat.
We had cooked meals. We had cooking apparatus on board. There was a flush toilet on board. And it was very spacious. You know, quite a lot of these aeroplanes, you had to crawl about in them to get into your position. But with the Sunderland, you could walk in, head up, and loads of room.
What did the members of the crew do? Where were they located in the Sunderland?
Well, we had three pilots. And so they were up front. Two pilots were always in the two seats. The one pilot that was off duty, he used to go into the Astrodome to do lookout duties. he would alternate with the two pilots. There was always two of the three flying the plane. The captain could be out of the main seat and off duty. As it were, he wouldn't be off duty completely, because if he wasn't flying it, he would be in the Astrodome doing his stint. There was a rear gunner, there was a mid-upper turret wireless operator air gunner, there was a front gunner in the nose. There were 12 guns. We had 12 guns on board, and it was nicknamed the Flying Porcupine. Because if everybody had stuck a gun out of the window, or stuck guns in position, there were 12 guns there, and there were about three free guns down the side of the aircraft. If you were in combat, you could pull that down, and I could go down and pick up a handheld gun, and we could muster about 15 guns to defend ourselves if we wanted to. It was
reliable, mechanically reliable.
Oh, very much so. Yeah.
What about your station, navigators?
Well,
what did you have?
I just had a navigation desk and a drift site. The Astrodome was right above me. I used to have to do astro navigation, because there were no navigation aids if you were right down at the bottom end of your patrol off Spain. There were no navigation aids down that way. And
now, what about, did you have any radar on it?
Yeah.
Now, was this your first time you had radar?
No, we had radar when I was on Wick, in Wick, ASV, air-to-sea vessel.
I thought you said you hadn't got radar on those.
No, we didn't have it when I first started.
But you got it after a while.
Yeah.
And how did the who used the radar? That wasn't you. That was who used the radar?
No, the radar was the wireless operators were air gunners were radar trained.
So that was it. Now, what about you? But you start your patrols, and they're longer. And immediately, they're 9 and 10 hours. You know.
12. Yeah. So.
Going up. Yeah. Just looking at a few pages. Now, what were the patrols like on the Sunderland? Bay of Biscay, still?
Yes.
They're still in the Bay of Biscay? Maybe.
Yeah, they were in the Bay of Biscay, yeah.
And what do you remember of the patrols?
Well, we used to start the patrol at Fastnet Lighthouse, which was way off the Land's End Point. We used to give him a couple of circuits and drop him the newspapers. On the lighthouse, most of them missed, and we used to take things, gifts to him. We'd gift him things, and the lighthouse keepers, and we'd fly off from there in the various directions. I think they were called floras. It'll have it there if it is.
I'm not quite. Whatever. Yeah. It's a bit difficult to pick up in the thing straight away. I can't see Flora just at the moment, but it probably was. And do you remember any patrols in particular?
Well, that was where we formated with a Focke-Wulf four-engined. A four-engine bomber that used to they used to send a few Focke-Wulf 120s, I think they were called. They used to pick up convoys and radio back to his base that convoys were in such and such a position, and send U-boats, divert U-boats to the convoys and things like that, and. We came across this Focke-Wulf and we got close to it, and in the end we were just about wingtip to wingtip and waving to each other, and he was out looking for convoys, and it wasn't his job to shoot us down, and we were in the same position that our job wasn't to shoot down Focke-Wulf, it was to spot U-boats. So we both we just sort of waved to each other and then said goodbye to each other and got about our job. On another occasion, I was in...
No, you didn't fire at it at all?
No, we just waved to each other and smiled, and it was wonderful, really. It was a great experience, that. It made me think that it's not people that cause wars, it's politicians.
And that was a Focke-Wulf 120? And you've got a couple more stories. I mean, that's the best way to take it, I think.
It might be in there, actually. It will be in there.
I can't see it just now, but there's quite a lot of it in here.
There's another one there where we were going to go down and land in the Bay of Biscay to pick up some Americans that were in dinghies. And there was already a Sunderland flying boat down there that was damaged on takeoff. And so they had to be rescued, and there were these people out of the American aircraft that had force landed there, but they wouldn't give us permission to land. Base wouldn't give us permission to land, and at the same time, told us that if we did land, that it would be under the threat of court martial. That it wasn't a done thing. You know, people think that flying boats can just land anywhere on water, but they can't. Because of swell, the weakest part of a Sunderland flying boat is the floats. And the floats are fixed to the wings, are not very rigid. And if you hit some swell and the float comes off, the wing will capsize. That's the Sunderland flying boat there. If you know what I mean, that boat's only as strong as those floats, the supports of that float.
Any other incidents you remember?
unless you can spot any in the logbook. As I said at the start of my interview, I was a washed out pilot. I had 63 hours. Now, Air Ministry came out with a ruling that any former failed pilots had to be encouraged to learn to fly the Sunderland Flying Boat, which of course was of great joy to me, that I was now back on the job that I joined the Air Force for, and that was to be a pilot. And if you can recall that I did say that there were three pilots, so there was never any need for me ever to take a plane off, because I didn't need any instruction in that, because the Sunderland, we'd start off with three pilots, but if we got into contact with the enemy by virtue of probably, we'll say, bombing a U-boat, it's quite conceivable that the pilots could be killed. And so as the navigator, I was the fourth man to take over. So I would then have to land that aeroplane. And so I was given instruction by my captain on landing the aircraft. So we would go up together, we would take the boat up and go around and do what we call circuits and bumps, and I would land the aeroplane, he would take it off again, he'd hand over to me, and I would get the chance to land it. So that was a nice diversion, that, and it never happened anywhere else in the service, but it happened in Sunderland, in Coastal Command.
And what was it like to fly?
Yeah, lovely to fly, yeah, no problem at all. And I did enjoy that little bit. Yeah, you wanted.
I believe you've got another story from a patrol. Tell us that.
Yeah. Well, I have mentioned earlier on that we hadn't any navigational aids in the Bay of Biscay, and our navigation wasn't very accurate, to say the least. But we probably knew where we were within 10 or 12 miles, which was good enough for us, but not good enough for the Navy. And somebody invented a system of navigation which was called CONSOL. Have you heard of it?
Tell us about it.
Well, CONSOL was a German system. It wasn't British at all. It was invented by Germans, and they had the same problem as we had about navigation in U-boats. U-boats who were under the water all day long didn't know how much currents in the water had blown them off, had forced them off the track that they wished to go on. They probably didn't know where they were within 12 miles like we didn't, and they invented this system of CONSOL, which was a system of dots and dashes, and we had to count how many dots there were, and we got hold of this system, and it came to us via Portugal. Now, Portugal was a non-combatant country. They were neutral, and they were our oldest allies, and they passed this information to us because there was a CONSOL beacon in Lisbon in Portugal. And the reason why the Portuguese let them have it, let the Germans build this beacon there, was because if they hadn't done it willingly, then they could have been invaded by Spain, because Spain were pro-Nazi, although they were neutral, but they weren't neutral really, but they were definitely pro-Nazis. In their civil war, the Nazis had helped them. So my crew was selected to trial this CONSOL, and we were given all the information. We were given the special maps that were were brought out and to cover it, and it was because that I was one of the senior navigators on this squadron, and they wanted the tests to be done as accurately as possible. What we were afraid of was that the Germans might find out that we intercepted this system and cut the system off. Now, if they cut the system off to us, of course, they would have cut it off to their own U-boats and aeroplanes that were using the same system, because their aeroplanes that were scouring the Bay of Biscay and beyond wouldn't really have good navigation the same as us. So when we went to briefing before we went on the trip, the pilot and I, the captain of the plane and I, had a special briefing. There were only two of us on this briefing, and my navigation was directed to everything that I did, I would check with consul. And we eventually worked out after a few, quite a few flights, that the Germans didn't know we were using consul. They didn't know we'd got hold of it. They didn't suspect that we'd got hold of it, because they didn't think that Portugal would give us the information, but Portugal did, because of the special relationship that we had between us. So we did a lot of the investigatory work on this consul system.
Now, how did it work, as far as you were concerned? What equipment did you have?
It was done on radio, and we just had to pick up the appropriate wavelength of the beacons that were being used, and tuned into a couple of beacons. There was one at Brest. There was one in Lisbon. That was two. There was one in Norway, but that wasn't any good to us. We were too far away. But one of the things about this consul system was that it was accurate to about 1,500 miles. And so that covered everywhere that we were flying in the Bay of Biscay. We did have other radar systems like G, but G was only accurate to about 100. That was no good to us out in the middle of the Atlantic. But coming back to base, it enabled us to find base. If there was any problem in finding base, we could just put the G system on, and there was a beacon, a G beacon at Pembroke Dock where we were flying from. And we just homed in on that beacon. I didn't do that. The wireless operator did that in conjunction with the pilot. So, that was a very big, navigationally, that was a very, very big thing to do, really.
Now, was it you doing it, or was it you just in the, with the wireless operator using console? No, it was
only me using.
So
my own radio system installed for me. They didn't know what I was doing. Nobody else on board knew what I was doing. The pilot did.
Did everybody start using console, or was it?
It was eventually used throughout the RAF, yeah. But I don't suppose Bomber Command used it, because they didn't need to. They had, you know, H2S and things like that that they used, which didn't need the range. You see, we needed a range, and when we got to 1,300 or 1,400 miles away from base.
Now, what about your commission? You said that happened quite soon after you joined the squadron.
Yeah.
What happened when you got your commission?
Well, we'd been on a patrol, and the wing commander, the CO of the squadron, came with us. And whilst we were out on patrol, the weather clamped, and we eventually, to get above it, had to go up to about 8,000 or 9,000 feet, which was a very big height for a Sunderland flying boat. I was using astro navigation to get back. I mean, I couldn't navigate. It was in the dark, and I couldn't navigate. I could have navigated if I'd used phosphorus floats, and it was, you know, I needed to find the wind and things like that, how that was affecting us. And so we got above the clouds, and I navigated back home on astro. And when we got back, he congratulated me and said that that he was. He said he, you know, he thought I'd done a good job and I was a good navigator and that I should be commissioned, and would I pop in and see him the next morning? So I did, and he just filled the forms out for me, and sent them off to headquarters in Plymouth, and from there on,
I just. Do you know when you were commissioned?
Pardon?
Do you know when?
When? I had. I can tell you, because I was in hospital when I had this accident that damaged my knees, and and my birthday's on the 31st of October, and I was in hospital then, and the reason why I didn't get told straight away was because I wasn't on the base, I was in hospital. So it must have been about the end of October, 1943.
Now, I'll come to the accident, because that's when we're going to go, but what about the commission? What difference did that make?
Well, it made none flying. I mean, I had no authority whatsoever in the air.
Well, I'll tell you what, tell us what it was like on the ground. What about the officer's mess? What was the
officer's mess? Well, I mean, it was great to be in the officer's mess instead of in the sergeant's mess, but we had pretty good conditions on the squadron. There's no difference. Rank was of no importance at all within the crew. I mean, the sergeant rear gunner could speak to me just as informally as he could speak to one of his own sergeant colleagues. I mean, rank didn't count for anything. I was a flight lieutenant and at a certain time, and my pilot was waiting for a commission. He hadn't been commissioned, so he was a flight sergeant, and that difference in rank made no difference at all.
And what was the officer's mess like? A Pembroke dog.
Yeah. Well, you know, I had a batman.
You wouldn't be there at Pembroke dog, would you?
Yes, I was. I was an officer there.
What was it like in the
office? And yeah, well, you know, it was just like a first class dining room, really. And there was games rooms and tennis courts. And
was it a hard drinking mess, or was it?
No, we celebrated when U-boats were sunk and things like that. We'd have a party and have a good night. I remember on one occasion, the navigation officer had a small mini car, and we took it up the steps of the church and left it in the middle of the aisle in church. But that was a naughty thing to do with that. But I wasn't involved in that, but it did happen. Yeah, we got up to hijinks when it was opportune, when it was necessary.
Now, there's a break in your service from late October to January.
Yeah. Right. Well,
that was the accident.
That's when I was in hospital.
The story of the accident. What was the accident?
Well, we'd been on one of the longest trips that I had done, and when we landed at night time in the dark, we couldn't land in Pembroke Dock because it literally was a dock, and that was where the Sunderlands were moored up. We had to land down at the mouth of the river, where it was wide, where the river itself was wide, and we had the space to take off safely and land safely. And we landed at night time down at the bottom of the river. Now, a pinnace used to come and pick us up off the boat, because we had to get ashore. We landed and tied up, and we had to get ashore. So the pinnace came and took us up the river to Pembroke Dock. There'd been an air raid. There were no lights. And The pinnace moored up alongside the dock, the harbour wall. Now, if you know docks closely, if you've ever done any sailing and things like that, you know that there are steps down where people go down to their little boats and get in their little boats when the tide's down. And on this particular occasion, the tide was down, and so we moored up alongside the harbour wall where this gap was. And instead of me going to the back end of the boat and getting ashore there where the boat was level with the harbour, harbour wall, I stepped off where that hole was, and it was about 20 feet, the tidal drop, and I dropped 20 feet. I had my sextant in my right hand and my navigation bag in my left. And instead of dropping them and sort of using my hands to try and break my fall, I kept hold of them. And so I landed on my knees from about 20 feet. If I'd been unconscious, I could have rolled into the water and possibly drowned. But I didn't think of anything like that at the time. All I wanted to do was to save my sextant from becoming damaged and make sure that I had my navigation back, because I was going to be briefed once I'd got ashore. I was going for a debriefing. And I reckon that what I did because I was tired. We'd taken off that morning down at the bottom end of the river, because it was night time when we took off, till about 7 or 8 o'clock in the morning. And when we got back at 6 o'clock at night, it was dark again, so we had to land down at the bottom end of the river. And I reckon that I was tired. We need about 2 hours before we take off. We've got to go down the river in the pinnace. And the day lasted probably 15 or 16 hours, and I think that I was tired, and that was what I did.
What have you done to your knees?
I tore it. A couple of cartilages, one in each knee, and the next morning I reported to the doctor on the station, and he sent me to hospital straight away, which was at Tony Pandy, which was just near Swansea or somewhere like that. That was the nearest hospital, and they took one cartilage out, and the other one they said was nicked and would probably mend, but it didn't. But that's when I had my first cartilage taken out, and the surgeon that took it out says that you'll get osteoarthritis one of these days. Well, when I left the service, within a month or two of leaving the RAF.
We'll come back if we do that. How long were you hospitalised for?
I was in hospital for about 10 days.
And then back to the squadron?
Yeah, and it was when I got back to the squadron that told me I'd been commissioned.
Now, there seems to be a gap there in your flying for a month, 2 months.
Yeah, because I couldn't fly.
So what were you doing? Just...
Oh, just wasting time, really. Christmas was around then, and I took a couple of weeks sick leave as part of that gap period, and then got back to the squadron and just hung around probably for a week or two. And then
you restart flying on, what, 27th of January?
Of January, yeah.
Right. 29th of January, your first operation.
Yeah.
Anything changed?
Oh, on the squadron, yeah, we'd lost a few aircraft. It was right at the height of action.
Now, what sort of casualties did you have?
Well, I should think that whilst I was on the squadron, which was about 10 months, that we probably lost 5 or 6 aircraft. That's 12 people on an aircraft. But we also probably in that time sank 5 or 6 U-boats.